Hello, and welcome to Charm City Checkup, a podcast about social justice issues in the city of Baltimore for pediatric residents made by a pediatric resident. My name is Janie Outlaw, and I am your new host. Currently, I am a pediatric resident in the city of Baltimore, aka Charm City. I am learning about community resources, social justice issues, and social determinants of health that face our patients and their families. Join me as I learn all things social justice in the beautiful Charm City. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Charm City Checkup, a podcast made by a pediatric resident for pediatric residents. Join us as we talk about all things social justice in pediatric health in the city of Baltimore. On today's episode, we will be talking about Group A strep, also known as Streptococcus pyogenes, common non-invasive Group A strep infections that we see in practice include strep pharyngitis, aka strep throat, and strep skin infections, which can include impetigo, cellulitis, erysipelas, making up several million cases per year. Strep pharyngitis is transmitted via respiratory droplets, while strep skin manifestations are usually transmitted via direct contact. Group A strep can also cause some more severe invasive infections, including bacteremia, septicemia, necrotizing fasciitis, and streptococcal toxic shock syndrome. Although less common than non-invasive infections, the CDC reports about 20,000 cases and 1,800 deaths per year in the United States from invasive strep infections. Finally, Group A strep can cause non-suppurative clinical manifestations of acute rheumatic fever and post-streptococcal manifestations. All in all, Group A strep is a small gram-positive cocci which appears in change and can do a lot of damage. So that's a little summary about Group A strep. And now for our interview with the Pediatric Infectious Diseases Fellow, Dr. Sumanth, a very awesome and very pleasure to have you with us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Wonderful introduction. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. So can you just tell us a little bit about your experience with Group A strep?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, I probably saw it more as a pediatric resident than I do as a pediatric infectious diseases fellow, primarily because we don't usually get consulted for Group A strep pharyngitis. But, typically, I think that there is certainly an age group where Group A strep pharyngitis is most common. And that age is typically in 5 to 16-year-old kids. It's typically in school-age children. In children who have household contacts, like older siblings, it can occur at younger ages. I would say that when you isolate Group A strep from a 2-year-old who doesn't have symptoms, you're usually looking at someone who's just colonized, which happens in about 5 to 15% of all children. Like you said, Group A strep pharyngitis, what I look for is enlarged tonsils, oftentimes with exudate. That is not by itself really enough to make that kind of diagnosis. You can certainly see exudative pharyngitis and viruses, specifically adenovirus. And sometimes in adolescence, you also have to think about HSV, which surprisingly can also cause exudative pharyngitis. Painful anterior cervical lymphadenopathy, fever, headache, abdominal pain are all very common. Abdominal pain can be so severe that sometimes people can mistake it for appendicitis. And then upper respiratory symptoms are almost always absent in classical cases of Group A strep pharyngitis in that age group, 5 to 16 years old. Like you mentioned, there's a separate illness called streptococcosis that actually happens in infants. And that's usually marked by a prolonged fever with generalized lymphadenopathy and serous nasal discharge. So that's streptococcosis. Scarlet fever, like you mentioned, usually happens with pharyngitis, but you can get it with really any manifestation of group A strep. So if you see someone with kind of a classic scarlatiniform rash and you don't see pharyngitis, reconsider the diagnosis of streptococcal scarlet fever. Think about things like Kawasaki disease, which can certainly also present with a scarlatiniform rash, but also look in other places, right? Perianal strep can certainly present with a scarlatiniform rash, and strep in other places can as well. Invasive group A strep infections can present with a scarlatiniform rash also. So rash is usually an erythematous, sandpaper-like rash. In darker-skinned individuals, it might be hard to actually physically see the rash, so feeling it can be very helpful. It usually appears around day two. It's blanchable, and it spreads throughout the body within several days. One thing that I always look for are pastia lines, which are deeper red lines that really happen in the neck, the axilla, and the folds of the elbow. And where I have seen them is usually in that elbow region. So those are like deeper red lines that you should be able to see. The tongue will have a strawberry appearance, which can make it difficult, again, to distinguish between this and Kawasaki disease. But one thing that I always say to people is that scarlet fever does not usually have associated conjunctivitis, and Kawasaki disease almost always does, at least classical cases do. If you do get labs on kids with group A strep pharyngitis or scarlet fever, you will often see liver involvement with elevations in their AST and ALT, and they can have a pretty significant bandemia. In fact, kids with group A strep pharyngitis can look quite ill, even if they don't have invasive group A strep. So certainly when you see someone in the ER who looks very sick, if they're in the right age group, checking for group A strep is, I think, wise, looking in their throat and deciding whether or not to check. Skin manifestations like impetigo are more common in younger children, usually between the ages of group 2 and 5. Usually about 10 days prior to onset of the actual infection, you'll get colonization. And then if there's a break in the skin, like eczema is a really classic example of something that can cause skin breakdown, then you can get an infection, the impetigo. And we typically think about the honey-crusted appearance of these lesions, kind of a classic board question. You want to treat that with topical mupirocin, but you can certainly use oral antibiotics as well, especially when it's widespread. And those, like you said, can certainly spread throughout the household. Another skin manifestation to think about, as you had mentioned, is erysipelas. And the way to distinguish this from neck fash is usually that it's very discreet and it presents with a raised area of skin, and there's very clear demarcation in where it occurs. And again, usually there's a preceding skin breakdown that happens to introduce the group A strep bacteria into that site. Children with erysipelas can look relatively toxic. So oftentimes I've had to admit patients to the hospital and treat them with IV antibiotics when they have it. Another skin manifestation to think about is perianal strep dermatitis. This usually happens in kids between the ages of 6 months and 10 years old. Oftentimes they'll have changes in their bowel habits. Occasionally they'll have blood in their stools, and they'll also be reporting perianal pain. Sometimes this can be, in younger children, this can be misdiagnosed as a diaper rash. But usually the way to distinguish between this and a diaper rash is that there's a very bright red ring just in the perianal region. Group A strep can also cause vaginitis in a similar vein in females. So if you ever see a urine culture that's positive for group A strep in a female, group A strep is not a urinary pathogen. Think about vaginitis and certainly examine the vaginal region and the vaginal area. Like you mentioned, there can be more serious manifestations like necrotizing fasciitis, mastoiditis, bacteremia, and streptococcal toxic shock. And these can happen at any age. Mm-hmm. Colonization is something that we really have to consider, especially in patients without classical symptoms. Again, 5 to 15% of patients are naturally colonized. And this is another reason why you should really limit testing to patients where there's a high pretest probability, because otherwise you're going to pick up a lot of kids who are colonized. There are criteria out there like the CENTAUR criteria, which I'm sure many listeners have heard of, is a classical criteria that's used. But I usually just go clinically. And one of my big deciding factors is like whether or not a patient is in the right age group and if they have upper respiratory symptoms. Because if they have upper respiratory symptoms in that age group, it's almost never group A strep. And then the other thing to consider is that, you know, you're not missing any cases of rheumatic fever or preventing any cases of rheumatic fever, or, and you're not preventing suppurative complications either if you treat patients who are colonized, right? And colonization is kind of controversial on how you deal with it. But in cases where someone keeps getting infected in the household or it becomes a nuisance, there are strategies that you can take to eradicate colonization. For testing, as you mentioned, I usually break it down. You can either use a two-step approach or a one-step approach. The two-step approach is usually antigen testing followed by either a culture or a PCR if the antigen is negative. If the antigen is positive, you can usually stop. Mm-hmm. But if the antigen is negative, which can happen in 10 to 20% of cases, then you can reflex that for culture. And in some cases, you can reflex to a PCR. And if that ends up being positive, then in a symptomatic patient, you can choose to treat. The other thing that you can do, which more and more centers are switching to, is just a one step with a PCR. And the sensitivity is pretty similar to culture. It's in the high 90s. So you don't have to do anything else if you get a positive PCR. You don't need, even if you get a negative PCR, you don't need to reflex it to culture.
Thank you for that. That was some great information and really helpful for those who are studying for their board. So I hope you guys are listening. Okay. So in Baltimore, have you seen a surge of group A strep infections?
Yeah. I think nationally we've seen an uptick in group A strep infections internationally, not just nationally. Both invasive and non-invasive. I'm not really sure we know all the reasons for the increase.
Okay.
But this really seemed to start in about 2022 and has really persisted over the last 2 years. I didn't actually see much invasive group A strep in 2022, but I saw a lot last year and this year. There are a lot of reasons why epidemics and outbreaks can happen. We're still trying to figure out why this international increase is happening right now. Okay. Oftentimes, different strains or serotypes can kind of move through the community at different times. And some strains and serotypes might be more virulent than others. And that oftentimes will depend on the M protein present on a specific strain. In the last 2 months alone, I've seen endocarditis caused by group A strep, osteomyelitis, and myositis. All of these patients have positive blood cultures. So I don't think we necessarily know exactly why it's happening, but yes, there is definitely a national upsurge.
For medical professionals, what should we know or truly understand about treating group A strep infection, especially in those ones that I wasn't as familiar with until you said, like the vaginitis and the perianal group A strep?
Yeah, so the treatment is penicillin.
Okay.
It's really the best treatment. It's efficacious. It's narrow spectrum. Mm-hmm. And rates of penicillin internationally for group A strep are basically zero. That's why if I get group A strep isolated, I don't even request susceptibilities. Like the lab won't routinely do them and I don't care because I know penicillin will work. Okay. If someone has an anaphylactic penicillin allergy and I have to use something else, then I might request susceptibilities, but like generally I don't. In children, we often use amoxicillin because penicillin is disgusting, the oral formulation. So children are more likely to take amoxicillin, which is also a primary treatment that you can use. So in older children and adults, you want to use 10 days of penicillin V, and younger children, 10 days of amoxicillin, or a single dose of IM benzathine penicillin is an alternative treatment option in adults and older children. Children will usually have significant reduction in organism burden in their throat, pharyngitis-wise, within 24 hours. And they can go back to school after 24 hours of treatment, provided that they're fever-free. For patients with non-anaphylactic penicillin allergies, I would use a first-generation cephalosporin, usually either cefalexin or cefadroxil.
Okay.
And if a patient has an anaphylactic penicillin allergy, you can either use a macrolide or clindamycin. However, it should be noted that resistance to both is increasing internationally. Historically, we avoided using Bactrim for group A strep due to old studies suggesting it wasn't useful. However, now there's new data that suggests that it does work against group A strep. But I am not aware of any studies that that look at its role in pharyngitis. So I certainly would not use Bactrim as a primary treatment in group A strep pharyngitis. And so if I see someone like in an outpatient clinic who has cellulitis, I would be fine using Bactrim monotherapy. Whereas a year or two ago, if I was using Bactrim, I would pair it with something like amoxicillin or a first generation cephalosporin to cover for group A strep. And then as we discussed for impetigo, oftentimes if it's localized, you can use topical antibiotics, but if it's more systemic, then I would suggest using oral antibiotics. And then levofloxacin and moxifloxacin cover group A strep, but cipro doesn't, which is something to keep in mind if you're covering for multiple organisms when you're doing something like occasionally I've had patients who have really bad pyelo when they get admitted to the hospital, but they're also positive for group A strep and they're really sick when they came in and I can't really figure out which is which, in which case I've used a fluoroquinolone for monotherapy to cover multiple things.
Okay.
Now, I have also run into situations where someone is like, oh, the patient got ceftriaxone. That doesn't necessarily prevent rheumatic fever. And here's the thing you need to know. Group A strep is exquisitely sensitive to antibiotics, especially most beta-lactams, and ceftriaxone is certainly one of those.
Okay.
So, you know, if you use ceftriaxone to treat someone, you certainly don't need to retreat them or, you know, like it's fine. Like, we just don't have data because those studies haven't been done yet, but more than likely, you know, if you needed to use something more broad spectrum for other reasons, then you don't need to worry about it.
Okay.
I would avoid using broad spectrum antibiotics unless you're really covering for multiple things. Treatment of invasive infection should also be with penicillin after group A strep is confirmed. If the patient is bacteremic, and I find out relatively quickly, like with BioFire blood culture ID system, I usually will start clindamycin or linezolid along with the penicillin, at least for the first 24 hours. That's because clinda and linezolid are protein synthesis inhibitors. Mm-hmm. And so they actually block toxin production. That's the entire point of using them along. So you shouldn't cover monotherapy wise, but like you should add them at least for, I typically add them for at least the first 24 hours to make sure that they're not producing toxin and getting worse. If there's no evidence of toxic shock syndrome after 24 hours, I will usually stop the protein synthesis inhibitor and cover with a penicillin monotherapy. If the patient has toxic shock syndrome, you really want to continue double covering until there's solid evidence of clinical improvement. Continue the protein synthesis inhibitor along with the agent that you're actually using to kill the group A strep. And then a couple of things you should know about group A strep toxic shock. Usually those patients are very ill. Unlike staph, they tend to be less fluid responsive and they will often require high doses of vasopressors. And that can result in significant morbidity. They can get purpura fulminans and they can get ischemic gangrene of their distal extremities, often requiring amputation. Strep TSS in general tends to have a higher mortality rate than staph TSS, and it also develops a little more slowly, so it's not recognized as quickly as staph TSS is. And the CDC has guidelines case definitions for strep TSS that I would really encourage you guys to take a look at, especially because there's a national outbreak of invasive group A strep right now. IVIG is an adjunctive therapy for invasive group A strep infections with toxic shock syndrome. So we can use that kind of its immunomodulatory effect with the toxin production, but there isn't really great data for its use, but we almost always use it in cases of group A strep toxic shock syndrome. I did see a case of group A strep toxic shock syndrome with associated group A strep meningitis in residency. But the kid did surprisingly well. And I know that there have been a few cases here in the last few months, even though I haven't seen any, but other members of our division have. So another thing to note about treatment of non-invasive group A strep, like pharyngitis, it's primarily for three reasons, which are symptom relief, prevention of suppurative complications, and prevention of non-suppurative complications. Mm-hmm. For symptom relief, you need to know that, you know, your symptoms are only really lessened by about 24 hours from getting antibiotics. So most non-invasive group A strep will resolve on its own with or without antibiotic therapy. Suppurative complications, we really think about things like peritonsillar abscess, mastoiditis, and adolescence, we think about something like Lemierre syndrome. But again, the number needed to treat to prevent one suppurative complication from group A strep is relatively high. And suppurative complications from group A strep are overall quite rare. Okay. Which brings us to the third reason, which is the non-suppurative complication that we can prevent, which is acute rheumatic fever. And we'll discuss that in a little more detail, I think, later in the episode. But I would say those are the primary highlights for group A strep treatment as I see them.
Okay. Thank you. And that's the next question I had was, you know, giving us some learning pearl for pediatric residents, but you've been dropping pearls the entire, you know, episode. So I'm just grateful for that. So one other question that I did have for you is just, what are some potential barriers to care and social factors that, you know, may impact the quality of care and outcome for our pediatric patients in Charm City?
Yeah. I think it's impossible to discuss discrepancies in group A strep without talking in more detail about acute rheumatic fever. Mm-hmm. So acute rheumatic fever is rare in the U.S., and that's for a multitude of reasons, you know, better healthcare infrastructure, but like also like in general, you know, this was true when I was in residency. I'm not sure if it's true anymore. The M proteins circulating in the U.S. are not as rheumatogenic as those circulating in low and middle income countries. And so, you know, I think I'll kind of talk a little bit about the discrepancies in a minute, but I think it's important to understand rheumatic fever, what it is. And you had touched on some of this a little earlier, but you remember the major and the minor criteria. And the major criteria, I usually remember using the mnemonic from first aid for step one. I never forgot it. It's called Jones with the heart for the O, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's joints, which is migratory polyarthritis. The heart is pancarditis, right? Valvular disease is what we think about the most, but certainly any part of the heart can be affected. N is subcutaneous nodules, which is actually the least common. Erythema marginatum, which is a serpiginous rash that is actually pretty fleeting. It can disappear. You can go in, see the patient, come out, get your attending, and the rash can be gone. It can go away pretty quickly. And then Sydenham's chorea. Actually, you need either two major or one minor, or one major and two minor, with evidence of preceding infection, which you can do either with a throat swab, an anti-DNase B, or an ASO. The exception to the one major and two minor, or the two major for diagnosis, is Sydenham's chorea. If you have Sydenham's chorea and you have preceding evidence of a group A strep infection, that's enough to make the diagnosis. And some would argue that if you have carditis with preceding group A strep infection in a highly endemic area, that's also enough to make the diagnosis. Other thing to remember here is that for minor criteria, group A strep, or for minor criteria, the PR interval only counts if you don't have carditis as a major criterion.
Okay.
So you can't use an EKG as a minor criterion if you have carditis as a major one.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Mm-hmm. And then treatment of ARF is typically with aspirin, especially if they have carditis, along with penicillin to eradicate the group A strep infection. Secondary prophylaxis is very important to understand and know for ARF because it will come up on your pediatrics boards. So for patients who had ARF without carditis, you want to give 5 years of antibiotic prophylaxis, typically with penicillin, or until age 21, whichever is longer. For patients who had ARF with carditis but without residual carditis, then you want to give 10 years or until age 21. For ARF, patients who had ARF with carditis with residual disease, you want to give either 10 years of antibiotic prophylaxis or until age 40, whichever is longer. Mm-hmm. And then some authorities suggest that if you have residual carditis, that you should actually get lifelong prophylaxis, especially in severe cases. Another thing that I just want to point out, if you ever hear a diastolic murmur in a pediatric exam room, you should consult cardiology. Mm-hmm. Systolic murmurs are almost always benign in pediatric patients, but diastolic murmurs are often not, right? Mm-hmm. I can think of only a handful of diastolic murmurs that I would not be concerned about, and one of those is a venous hum. which is often a continuous murmur. It almost sounds like interference. Okay. But diastolic murmurs are usually not normal in pediatric patients. So if you hear what you think is a diastolic murmur, you should refer. And especially as a late complication, you can get mitral stenosis, which is indeed a diastolic murmur, although usually you would be hearing that in adulthood. So yeah, I mean, those are really important to remember. And as far as like barriers to care, I think ARF is really important to note here, right? So I think the barriers to care exist on two levels, right? In low and middle income countries, oftentimes patients don't have access to antibiotics. Mm-hmm. When they do have access to antibiotics, sometimes those antibiotics can be counterfeit or substandard, and they're often prescribed over the counter, by traditional healers or pharmacists. And if the antibiotic is inappropriate against group A strep, or the antibiotic is substandard or counterfeit, it won't do its job in actually eradicating group A strep. And that, especially in an area where rheumatic fever is highly prevalent, remember, it is the number one cause of acquired heart disease in children around the world. Although in the United States, that distinction belongs to Kawasaki disease. In fact, my uncle, who grew up in rural India, and I probably had an unrecognized group A strep infection as a child, and he has really severe rheumatic fever with valvular disease. And he's required several open heart surgeries due to the severity of his cardiac function. It's really important to promote education in settings, especially in, because group A strep pharyngitis, for the most part, is not a severe illness. So mm-hmm. oftentimes parents may just decide to ride it out at home. And so in highly endemic areas, it's really important to educate people as to how important this illness is. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit about Baltimore and the mm-hmm. United States specifically, right? And so the way I see it in Baltimore or in the US is that, again, the differences, I think, exist on several levels. So children may not have access to regular primary level care, right? Mm-hmm. And so because of that, they may go to an urgent care center or another facility where people don't have as much experience treating children. And they might be tested inappropriately or treated inappropriately by people who don't really know how to interpret group A strep results in kids. Mm-hmm. And that would increase selective pressure in AMR. I think there's already evidence that AMR disproportionately affects the poor, both outside the United States and in the United States. And then, right, you think about supportive and non-supportive complications. Well, who gets diagnosed with those, right? Who gets preventive measures to prevent, like who actually are caught with those kinds of infections early? Kids who have good relationships with their pediatrician, right? Mm-hmm. And so not having access to reliable follow-up will also make it difficult for kids to have early diagnosis of something like a peritonsillar abscess or a mastoiditis, in which case they might present late in the course of illness, making it more difficult to treat. And then as far as non-supportive complications, diagnosing ARF is not a picnic, right? It can be quite challenging. You need to have a relationship with a pediatrician, someone you can go to when you feel like something isn't going well or something isn't going right. And so I think it's really important to recognize that barriers to care can impact people even for a disease as common as group A strep.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is very true. And it is our duty to, you know, continue to have these conversations and continue to educate outpatients so that they know we are here in the community as resources and as providers who, you know, are happy and very eager to help treat group A strep. Yes. Well, those were all of my questions for this episode. Do you have any remaining or last words that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, I can. I'll quote my mentor in residency actually wrote a textbook, and mm-hmm. he has like a list of group A strep learning pearls that I hope that you guys will take forward in your careers. Number one is don't test anyone you wouldn't treat for group A strep. A positive result is a lab guide, and it should not be your primary decision point, mm-hmm. right? Don't treat patients without lab confirmation of group A strep. Don't look for asymptomatic carriers in most cases. Don't culture for other bacteria in most cases, although it can be important for things like peritonsillar abscesses. But for straightforward pharyngitis, don't look for it unless you have a strong reason to. Don't treat with broad spectrum antibiotics unless it's one of those situations that I mentioned where you're trying to cover for multiple things at the same time. Mm-hmm. Don't get follow-up testing in most cases. Don't get ASO titers unless you suspect rheumatic fever. And don't get CRP, WBCs, or a CBC with differential in straightforward cases of strep pharyngitis. They will be abnormal, and you're not going to know what to do with that result.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Seemoth. This was such a pleasure and such a great learning experience, and I hope my listeners feel the same. So we really appreciate you, you know, spending time with us at Charm City Checkup.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Yes. Thank you. Well, that's all we have today for Charm City Checkup. And I hope everyone has, you know, at least gained one learning pearl from this episode. Until next time, listeners, have a good one. Thanks for listening to this episode of Charm City Checkup, a podcast about social justice issues in the city of Baltimore for pediatric residents, made by a pediatric resident. Special thanks to medical students Juliana Solomon and Olivia Girvan for research and editing. Please follow us on Instagram at Charm City Checkup, and feel free to reach out with any questions or episode ideas by emailing charmcitycheckup@gmail.com. Please remember that all opinions expressed on the podcast are mine and not necessarily shared by my employer. Until next time, Charm City Checkup, have a good one.